From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, G. Edward Griffin joins us. He returns. The creature from Jekyll Island. Here's what's happening. Well, if you smoke, take heed to this story. If you get secondhand smoke, you might as well listen to it as well. Tobacco use apparently kills at least 5 million people every year, a figure that could rise if countries don't take stronger measures to combat smoking, according to the World Health Organization. In a new report on tobacco use and control, the UN agency said nearly 95% of the global population is unprotected by laws banning smoking. WHO said the secondhand smoking kills about 600,000 people every year. Never been a cigarette smoker, but I'm telling you, this is being pushed to get higher taxes on tobacco on everybody worldwide. Watch it happen. President Obama's top climate change negotiator arrived in Copenhagen, swinging back at Chinese demands for the United States to increase its emission reduction goals. China is the world's largest greenhouse gas emitter, overtaking the United States in recent years. No agreement will result from the Copenhagen conference without real commitment from the Chinese, they say. Listen to this story. The Colorado scientist, described by the Washington Post as the world's most famous hurricane expert, says the ClimateGate emails from the United Kingdom that revealed possible data manipulation are evidence of a conspiracy among warmists, those who believe man's actions are triggering possibly catastrophic climate change. He's the Colorado State University's William Gray, and he said the recent ClimateGate revelations coming out of the UK are but a tip of a giant iceberg of a well-organized international climate warming conspiracy that has been gathering momentum for the last 25 years. Professor William Gray's annual hurricane forecasts are the standard for weather prognostications. His work pioneered the science of forecasting hurricanes, and he has served as the weather forecaster for the U.S. Air Force as well. Bridget Hoagland over at theenterprisemission.com has an interesting story about climate change in 2012, if you want to take a look at that. On the coasttocoastam.com website, our feature story is one that's been happening over the past day or so. It's out of Norway, and it's bizarre. Look, up in the sky, is it a bird? Is it a plane? Is it a rocket? What really is it? A mysterious light display appearing over Norway has left thousands of people in the northern part of the country baffled, and now this has caught on to YouTube, the rest of the internet, and it's all over the planet. Witnesses have compared this amazing sight to just about anything, from a Russian rocket to a meteor or shockwave, although no one appears to have mentioned really yet UFOs. The phenomenon began when what appeared to be a blue light seemed to soar up from behind a mountain. It stopped midair, then began to circulate. We've got Charles Osman on. He is currently the senior fellow at the Institute for Global Futures. Charles, this is a bizarre, bizarre story. What do you think? I think this could be a Russian rocket, but I'm not sure.
Some say it is a Russian accident. I don't think it's an accident at all. I think it's a perfectly successful experiment. It's one of many which have been sort of quietly brewing in the background. And I say this because there's kind of a race been going on. We've talked about this before. In fact, the last issue of After Dark, I did a little small piece just highlighting this topic briefly. This idea that the next thing that's going to be the battleground of the planet. It's not going to be over landmass or over waterways or shipping rights or that kind of thing. It's going to be over atmospheric control. And I say this for a very specific reason, because for many, many years, there's been huge amounts of money and huge investments in terms of different kinds of defense programs and so forth, determining exactly what are the criteria that would be required to alter the passage of jet streams, to make weather changes in a certain way, to have strategic access to middling storms for both peaceful and perhaps non-peaceful reasons, but that's only a tip of a larger iceberg. I mean, I'll be talking about this on Sunday with Ian Punnett for a variety of reasons.
Well, are you saying, though, that this is a Russian, is it some kind of new weaponry, or what do you think it is?
I think it's part of an experiment to have yet another attempt or another avenue by which they can manipulate the ionosphere. for any variety of reasons. As we all know, HARP has been owning it for many, many years. That's the High Altitude Auroral Research Project here in Alaska. There's many of these HARPs, by the way. It's not just one, but there's a whole variety of things. And people began to realize many years ago that the first, of course, version of this was actually to develop what's called over-the-horizon radar. They wanted to create a reflective medium within the ionosphere so they could bounce radar waves and then see targets across the horizon. Of course, when satellites became common, then this was less interesting. But what they discovered along the way was because we can inject huge amounts of energy into the ionosphere, we can create other kinds of effects. We can create hotspots and also create other things, which are quite interesting, quite useful, should there be a need to do this kind of thing. In recent times, as we've seen, experiments in China, we've seen experiments in Russia in the past where they tried different experiments, some of which had very strange, unexpected consequences. But a thing that I'll offer to you now, if you look at the global economy, since this is kind of the issue of the day, the things that affect the global economy that can be traced back to certain areas of sovereignty or liability rights or liability exposure, that kind of thing, are usually confined to what are called acts of God, quote-unquote, and I use that term rather really loosely here. Now, weather is, of course, the most sort of the most common example, and other natural phenomena like earthquakes, tsunamis, and so on. Well, what if portions of these events are no longer acts of God, but in fact contrived events?
Uh-huh.
How would that play into an economic sort of battleground in the future?
Good point.
You see where this might be going, and fact that you just raised, and in fact, that's very interesting, and I commend you for this, that you just talked about China and global warming. Well, a couple of thoughts I want to toss in, if I may. About back in 2004, 2005, I attend a lot of different kinds of conferences, many of which have to do with the intersection of technology, economic policy, geopolitical, you know, that sort of thing. And I began attending conferences that were about the investment opportunity of, get this, carbon credits. And the people who were building these different kinds of investment platforms, including derivatives and futures trading, the whole nine yards, were exactly the same people, and I mean exactly the same people, who were, of course, inventing the mortgage-backed securities that, of course, have now caused this collapse of the Western economy, by which they had made trillions of dollars. And even then, before the housing crash started, and a lot of us saw the crash coming, we said, wait a minute, you can't have 10, 12, 15% increase perpetually with real estate. That's idiotic. Nobody's
it's absurd, yeah.
And yet, we were in the audience, a lot of very smart people around me, they're saying, well, what's the real game plan? I mean, these aren't stupid people. These are some of the brightest people in the room. How can they do this? And they were already planning for the next big thing. Once the real estate bubble burst, and they all knew it was going to happen, the next thing around the corner, carbon credits. I swear, I was sitting there, I was kind of thinking, wait a minute, there's something kind of weird in this picture.
Yeah, Charles, so, there's no doubt. You're on to something. Look, we're going to look forward to your interview this weekend with Ian Punnett. And I got to tell you, when I was a kid, I used to build model rockets. I'd launch them. And sometimes, if they didn't go straight, they spiraled. And they went around and around and around in this circular formation. Not like this. This is weird. And this blue beam that comes right out of the center of it is very peculiar. So this could be some kind of atmospheric or some kind of earth change manipulation going on by the Russians. Keep in mind, everybody, though, isn't there a HARP-type project over in Norway? And this looks very, very strange. But if you want to see it all, it's up there at coasttocoastam.com. Charles, thank you so much. The year's best meteor showers coming to North America, weather permitting. The peak time to view the Geminid meteor shower will be around midnight Sunday Eastern time, when up to 140 meters per hour could streak across the sky. Who watches the sky for us? And you? None other than Stephen Cates. Dr. Sky, another great meteor shower, Stephen.
Absolutely, George. Good morning to you and all the Coast listeners. This is a great time of the year. Some say, George, that this is actually the best meteor shower of the year. And I kind of need a little help because we talked last month about the Leonids, and somehow they kind of just pooped out for us. But this one, folks, should be good. And here's why. As you mentioned, George, sky watchers looking into the southern part of the sky, the constellation of Gemini, which, by the way, that's where the sun is during the summer, so thus it's really high for northern hemisphere viewers. These meteors are all thought to come from, well, at least the astronomers thought, an extinct asteroid, meaning an extinct comet, which then became an asteroid, 3200 Phaethon, as it's the original name. But this shower was actually discovered by observers back around the time of the Civil War. And here's the good news. The shower is getting better because the Earth is moving deeper into the debris field, And the Geminids are classically known, George, for the very bright, slow fireballs, making up for the lack of the fast little meteors that the Leonids didn't produce this year. And it should actually be one of the best showers. And as you mentioned, go out of doors. If you're able to look out in the cold, clear skies, the moon will not interfere. But if you look high up into the south at the time of sunset or starting to look into that part of the northeastern sky, all night long, we're hoping, as just many people out there, that you get to see some of the space debris. Get a lot of this. Maybe all the size of a grain of sand, or maybe a little larger than that, like the little thumbnail that you have on your small little finger, maybe that size. But these should be good. They should be bright, and it should be quite exciting. And always, George, I'd like to mention to the Coast listeners, of course, check your latest After Dark magazine for the Dr. Sky column. It gives you a little bit more detail for this good show.
Absolutely. Thanks, Stephen. And Stephen's website will be up there at our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. A chemistry student in the Ukraine has been found dead with his jaw blown off by what is believed to be exploding chewing gum. The 25-year-old disfigured remains were discovered at his parents' home in a northern Ukrainian city. The young man, who studied at a polytechnic institute, was working at a computer late at night when the alleged explosion began. Wildlife officials are frantically hunting for a wild elephant, which they believe is responsible for the deaths of 11 people in Nepal. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner has told Congress that the administration will extend the government's financial bailout program until next fall, saying it's needed to protect against fresh economic shocks. And Bank of America Corporation apparently has paid back its $45 billion in TARP funds, marking an official end to the Charlotte Bank's most chaotic chapter, in which it counted the U.S. government as a reluctant and hard-nosed advisor. And Edward Scissorhands, you all saw the movie with Johnny Depp, right? Well, now those scissors may be real. A hairdresser in Florida has invented a scary-looking fingertip razor blade. It's an attachment he believes will revolutionize the industry. He's already spent close to $250,000 developing this menacing-looking claw, which he says shaves the time it takes to cut hair. I'm not sure I'd want my hair cut by somebody moving his fingers up and down next to my ears. Up next, from birth to rebirth, Charles Tremont, back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Dr. Charles Tremont received his MD at the New York Medical College in 1962. He had a very successful career. In addition to this prominent medical career, he also achieved the rank of colonel in the United States Air Force, serving in the Vietnam War and Operation Desert Storm. His book, From Birth to Rebirth, Gnostic Healing for the 21st Century. And here is Dr. Charles Tremont back on Coast to Coast. Charles, how are you?
Hi, George.
Always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, I just want to thank you for inviting me, and I'd like you to know that your invitation that I received in the latter part of January has been a very welcomed impetus to my research, and I'm very thankful. Yeah, I've now communicated with people from at least 47 states and many foreign countries, and I've seen almost all of them. As a result, I've learned quite a bit. And I want you to know your audience is not only massive, but very well enlightened, and I salute you for the work you're doing.
Thank you, Charles. I mean, I tell you what, they keep us busy, and they keep me on my toes. When I do several conferences around the country every year, and we always do a question and answer session after that, and I got to tell you, if you're not ready for them, you're in trouble. And they are very well versed at this subject.
I'd say so, yeah.
So I'm glad they're helping you out with this, too. You know, I've been talking to so many people during this holiday season about, you know, spirituality and life after death and just what is this journey we all go to. Tell us about your journey, Charles. How did you get to where you are?
Well, if you remember last time, I think I told you I started off going to a course on hypnosis that was given by another medical doctor. And I was so fascinated by what I had observed, and I could see a tremendous potential for healing, that then I began reading books on hypnosis, especially past life regression, and got into Brian Weiss's work and so on, and then I really got turned on. And anyway, I guess I was activated for Desert Storm. By the time I got back, then I started to have a lot more courage, and I went and plunged myself right into it, and did this with patients who were willing to do this, especially patients who were terminal that I'd operate on and, you know, didn't have more than several months to live. And just doing this for them gave them this feeling of being eternal. They faced death in a much different way. And it also gives people tremendous perspective to face life, knowing truly who you are, that you're this eternal being. So that was a tremendous boost. And then, of course, I had some early patients who just blew me away with being able to validate many of their lifetimes and then exhibiting xenoglossy where they could speak a foreign language unknown to them.
Jeez.
So those things were very impressive.
Do you sometimes, in your therapy sessions, have you taped them and then you play it back for them and they listen to it and they go,
you know,
oh
what,
my gosh.
I tape very rarely. It kind of interferes, and I find that it's very important to be creative, you know, when you're doing this kind of work. And I kind of need all my wits about me and not having to worry about, you know, turning things on and off and all that business. So I find it kind of detracts from things, but the creativity is really important. I mean, a simple thing like taking somebody back to the cause of their problem, which is what I do very often. And you do use different techniques like taking them through a door, a doorway, that kind of thing. Sometimes they're exceptionally nervous. I mean, really nervous. And when that happens, you know, you think on your feet, and I say to them, look, I'm going to take your hand, and I'm going to lead you through that, and I'll be there for you. And I do that. I'll, you know, pick their hand up, and all of a sudden they calm down, and they go right through. The creativity is just really important in this kind of work. It really is.
When they come to you with issues and problems, generally, what are they?
Oh, well, the ones that I've been able to really make a difference, I'm going to just kind of rattle off things that come into my mind here.
Sure, sure.
But I, you know, very commonly I see depression, anxiety, especially chronic anxiety. I've had people with anxiety overtaking examinations, feelings of deserving punishment, abandonment, anger, rage, insomnia. And then phobias, agoraphobia, and all other types of fears. And then, of course, there's the chronic alcoholism, drug addiction, sexual dysfunction, and then some real, you know, borderline medical situations that they're not sure was causing them, like ulcerative colitis. Then people have blocks to their continuing to do what they need to do in work or at home or whatever, in advancing their career. Some people are writers, or they're unable to take action or follow through.
We call it writer's block.
Right.
Yeah.
I've got a very interesting story on that, I'll tell you. But addictions to, like, smoking and gambling and, of course, panic attacks, a lot of those. Pain, all types of pain, TMJ, epigastric, hip, back, you name it. Feelings of, I think I told you last time, of running out of time. Insecurity. And, of course, headaches and despair and hopelessness and suicidal thoughts. These are things the dark forces push into you. Inability to lose weight. And, you know, forgiveness is a big part of healing, for it releases the patient from the chains that really bind them in negative thinking. You know, resentment and anger and desire to get even or see someone punished are things that kind of rot your soul and tear down your health. So if you want to be permanently healed, you really have to do some forgiving. But it takes the chains off of you, because it's not helping the other person, it's helping you.
And when you start working with them, especially through hypnotherapy, for example, are all of them cases that have been, I guess, are they, I'm going to use the phrase, are they screwed up because of their past lives?
Well, I look at it, first of all, I'll take people back to the causes, but before I do that, I like to utilize the spirit guide. I really like working with the guide, and it's very important that I get a spirit guide, because I get a lot of important information about the patient. But one of those pieces of information is there any foreign energy present? And that's what I've run into an awful lot of. So I'm of the mind now that the problems either lie in a triggering of an event that happened, you know, in a past lifetime, and now it's brought back.
All right, let's talk more about that, Charles, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Dr. Charles Tremont. Charles, you were talking about the spirit guide, the helper here with the patient. Elaborate a little bit more for me on that.
Well, what I do, one of the main questions I ask the guide are, is there any foreign energy present? And, you know, I believe that just like William Baldwin did, the guru of spirit release and therapy, that there are different types of entities, and I'm pretty much along the same lines as his thinking, that there are human forms which imprint their emotional and physical ailments upon the host, and there are non-human forms that complete their agenda. And sometimes patients' issues are due to a combination of both. They're either emotional or physical problems that are being caused by deeply buried subconscious memories that have come to the surface in the forefront of the subconscious mind and now have a tremendous effect on the conscious mind in a negative fashion, or they're due to attached entities. And I feel that both those particular areas need to be explored completely if you're going to cure a patient of their problems.
Now, let's get into these problems and how you go about helping them. Take us kind of through a session, if you would.
Well, what I do is I'll carry out a pretty lengthy interview. I like doing my interview in a session. I don't sit there and split it up in different days and things like that. I think that's silly. But I have the patient describe their issues in great detail. And then I kind of develop an impression or feeling regarding their belief system and how open they are, especially to concept of, like, reincarnation. In the process of doing this, I talk about historical validation of lifetimes, past lifetimes, and xenoglossy, and the almost identical descriptions of the afterlife that have come forth from millions of people who have been regressed, and also from those millions of people who have had near-death experiences. They're almost identical descriptions. And to me, that's a tremendous proof of sorts. And then I explain my philosophy and beliefs, namely that I feel every emotional and physical problem that a person endures most likely has an emotional cause, which is buried in the subconscious memory. I think the psychiatrists are missing the boat. I think that the problems aren't in the conscious mind, they're in the subconscious. And something occurs in the person's present life that triggers the memory to the forefront of the subconscious mind. And when that happens, it now has a tremendous effect on the conscious mind in the form of negative programming. And I let the patient know that they'll be protected from any physical or emotional discomfort through my suggestions during the hypnosis. And we'll have a spiritual protection as well by surrounding them with light. And unless I'm asked, I purposely do not discuss attachments. Rather, I ask the patient to be open to whatever occurs, to stay relaxed and go with the flow. And I do this on purpose so as not to lead them.
Right.
And most patients are less surprised when we discover attachments. And then I discuss this thoroughly following the session. I find that that technique adds an element of candor and genuineness to the whole process. And then I discuss hypnosis, the whole story of it and how it's formed and what it's all about, the process of deepening. Most of the patients I've seen have never undergone hypnosis. And then I gently take the patient into the state of hypnosis.
And they spill the beans.
Yeah. I am always being surprised. like I said, you got to be creative because you never know what you're going to run into. I mean, you'll see what I mean as I describe a few things to you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you had mentioned a writer who had problems. Tell us that story.
Oh, yeah. That was a particular patient who had a block to writing, and that was quite interesting. If I remember correctly, she felt like there was a link between her and Edgar Allan Poe. She felt like she actually had a past lifetime as Edgar Allan Poe. And And this is quite interesting. And this particular case stirs a lot of empathetic emotions within me. This gal had psychic gifts, and she had a healing power. But at the same time, she wrote poetry and fiction, which was tinted with dark romanticism, very much like Edgar Allan Poe. So when she said she thought she was him, and she felt like this because she had obsession with death, and she used words that she, you know, incorrectly, very correctly, but that she wasn't even familiar with. It just came to her. So I thought we may have something here. But she had a bunch of issues that included the block to her creative writing, and she also felt a pressure, a mental deadline to finish this kind of writing. So anyway, I got a hold of a patient spirit guide who identified the fact that she did have foreign energy, including one dark force entity and many earthbound spirits. And several of the earthbounds, and what I do is, when there's a bunch of them, I address them either all at once, or I may take them one at a time and interview them, like, what's your name, how long you've been here, what's your purpose?
Are they cooperative with you, Charles?
Oh, yeah, very much so. I will ask them, in your lifetime, did you have depression problems? Were you anxious or this kind of thing? And I say, you know, if, like in this particular case, as I went through these earthbounds, I asked, is there any earthbound spirit here who is an author? And one step forward, and his name was Edgar Allan Poe.
This blew me away.
And he's telling me he was trapped in his thoughts. He hadn't finished his work or earthly lessons, and therefore declined going to the light. And I called for his spirit guide, who showed up and then revealed the presence of foreign energy within him. And that happens often, that these earthbounds also have energy. Usually it's dark forces that hook onto them. At that moment, one more of the patient's spirit guides came forward, said his name was St. Jerome. And he was full of a lot of information. He said that both Edgar Allan Poe and the patient were responsible for the mental pressure to finish the writing. However, the patient herself is causing the block because she's afraid of being successful. And this was due to a past life incident I checked on her, where she was successful in a past life as a singer. And I think she was somehow attacked in that lifetime because she was successful. But St. Jerome also said that Edgar uses her light and she sees out of his eyes, and that she loves him because she thinks she is him. So I ended up removing all the foreign energy from Edgar Allan Poe and from the patient, except for Edgar Allan Poe and two extraterrestrials who I came upon. And the reason I did that is because the spirit guides felt these ETs were exceptionally helpful in helping the patient's healing ability.
Along with Edgar Allan Poe, right?
Right. And then I consulted the three guides and said, hey, should Edgar go to the light? Is this a good idea? And I do this. I'll put it up for their consultation. They informed me then that the patient and Edgar Allan Poe made agreements in the astral plane prior to this lifetime. They agreed that somehow the patient was to continue Edgar Allan Poe's work and tell people how he was misunderstood, that he was really a gentleman, that he wasn't dark, that he respected women and all this business.
Amazing.
And at that moment, I just interrupted, and I suggested that. I said, hey, you know, why doesn't the patient write a biography about Edgar Allan Poe and include all this stuff? And all of a sudden, Edgar became noticeably excited about this proposition. And this is what's happened.
But he didn't stop you and say, wait a minute, I got to talk to my literary agent, right?
No.
He didn't say that.
No, but he thought that was a wonderful idea. And then the guides came forth with a little bit of a truism. They said, you know, you could help her even more from the light. So Edgar made his choice to go to the light and did so with my help. And it was a very emotional ascent to the light as I could see tears coming in the patient's eyes.
Amazing.
And as the session came to a close, I heard the guides talking about other agreements they made in other lifetimes and in the afterlife and so on. So I went ahead with the protection and the and the ceiling light on them, and that ended that session. But man, that was that was a real wild one.
That was. Do these spirits, like Edgar Allan Poe, the spirit of Poe, do they attach themselves to just one human, or could it attach itself to 60 people out there?
The Earthbounds, as far as I know, are able to attach to one particular person. What I think you're getting at is, I told you a long time ago, I used to get some gifts from spirit guides, and one of the gifts was explaining the phenomenon of the walkthrough phenomenon, which means that before you do a permanent incarnation, you kind of look over the Akashic records, and you join another soul in a body, the same body, to learn a specific lesson from a specific angle, and be there for just a temporary period of time, and then leave, and then do your permanent incarnation. And I've checked with other guides since then, and that's exactly the way they describe it. And usually they said it's just a famous person. I said, well, why a famous person? Because that's where the action is. That's where the experience is. And so that is why we end up with a lot of Cleopatras, a lot of, you know what I mean? A lot of people say, well, they can't all be. Well, they may all be. And I don't know if I explained last time. You may have asked me about famous people last time. I can't remember. Did I tell you about Edgar Cayce?
I don't recall that.
Okay, well, I've got a patient who I know is Edgar Cayce.
Now,
there's a guy named Wilcox at the Edgar Cayce Institute promulgates as the incarnation.
That's David.
As Edgar Cayce. But this particular individual, you know, he was a photographer, et cetera, just like Edgar. And I took him back to a prominent moment in that lifetime, and he went into trance. Edgar Cayce in trance, a sleeping prophet, where he would come up with all these medical treatments and never remember anything from the trance. And he did exactly that. But you know what I did at that time is I had this bone spur on my ankle. And I was chief of surgery for a while. I know that surgery is not a good answer for that kind of thing. This is a pretty good-sized spur, and it was causing pain and so on. And you know, they love to operate on those, but when they operate, you take 6 months to walk, and then you may walk funny after that. So I said, what would you do for this bone spur, Edgar? And he gave me a poultice. He says, well, you take some olive oil and turmeric, the spice, and some DMSO to get it to absorb real quickly. And I've done this for several months, and the thing's gotten smaller and smaller It's down to about a fourth of its size. It's amazing. So, you know, this stuff is for real. And I've also had other very prominent people, a guy who was Doc Holliday, a guy who was Black Elk, and one guy who was Nostradamus.
But see, you had Nostradamus?
I had a guy who was not, and this particular guy consciously kept saying, it's not possible. It's not possible. I mean, these things come through, and then sometimes it gets so preposterous the conscious mind doesn't know what the heck to do with it.
Yeah, yeah. Is there this raging battle, Charles, between good and evil? Do you find that?
Okay, you're asking for it now.
Here we go. Fire away.
Here we go. Okay, this is something else. Okay. I feel there's definitely this battle raging between good and evil. And my research, you know, is leading me very much to believe that these dark force entities that I run into are exceptionally real. I've talked to Judith Baldwin. You're familiar with her, I'm sure.
Yes. Sure.
And she tells me that her husband, you know, the more he would remove dark forces, the more powerful ones they would send against him. And that's precisely what I'm running into.
They're coming at you like crazy.
Oh, yeah. And in my mind, their mission is simply seduction and destruction. And they're very responsible for, you know, all these negative thoughts, suicide and all that business. And they know when I'm coming after them. They know when they're in danger of being discovered. I laugh when people, and I hear it all the time, they come to see me and they say, well, they're an hour late because they couldn't find me, you know, or they said, my wife and I both developed pain and we didn't know if we should come or not. You know, this is what they do. At any rate, I'm definitely getting their attention. And let me show you why that's so. I had a middle-aged woman in the early part of the year who had a lot of these dark forces. And as soon as she entered in hypnosis, she began writhing all over the couch with occasional growls. And she was just all over the place. And obviously, the dark forces, I felt, knew they were about to be discovered. And all of a sudden, she sat up like a shot. And her eyes were still fluttering, and she was deeply entranced. And she looks right at me, even though she's not looking at me. And a loud voice says, "Who are you?" So I simply answered, I'm the guy who's going to get rid of you." And I laid her back down, and we proceeded and removed those dark forces. Another gal was from South America. I took a bunch of dark force entities off of her. She came in the next day to just inform me. Says, "Right before you removed those entities, I heard a voice, and it kept saying, 'He's getting across. He's getting across.'" Well, whenever I'm dealing with dark forces, I get up from my chair, I walk over to a table in my office, and I pick up a crucifix that I've had since the fourth grade. And this lets the dark forces know where I stand, and it adds power to the process. Yes. And so it's obvious they're also watching me, and they know exactly what I'm doing. And then I had a guy who was told by a shaman that he had spirits attached. Well, this guy was very nervous, and he didn't even want to proceed with whatever we were going to do. I could not get his spirit guide, and I found myself communicating with a guy named Joseph. I thought maybe it was an earthbound. And Joseph's being very helpful. He's saying, "Hey, there are thousands of dark force entities present." Now, you got to remember, too, many times dark forces will even pretend to be spirit guides. At any rate, I said...
They try to trick you?
Oh, always. They're very deceptive, yeah. They'll lie through their teeth. So I said, "What's your purpose in being here?" And he said, "I love to do this." So now I knew I was dealing with a dark force. At any rate, what I did then at that point is I've had this problem getting, when I've got a bunch of real dark forces or powerful ones, whatever, I have a problem getting the guide. And what I'll end up doing is I ran into a spirit guide who was rather advanced, almost master level, with another patient, and I ran this question by him. I said, "What is it? What do they do? How do they do this? How do they keep me from getting to the guide?" And he said, "They exude a fog, like a mist, that keeps the guide from coming through." So I said, "So what'll I do?" And he says, "Call me." I have, and about almost a dozen times, that he's come through. But there's been a few times that he hasn't come through. And so what he does is he comes through, the patient's voice, and he monitors and confirms everything for me, too. Well, in this particular case, we used him again. And he said, "We indeed have several thousand dark forces present." So I used my usual protocol, and we confirmed the removal of all the dark force entities, except for four, including Joseph, who Abel now tells me is a very powerful dark force entity. So I invoked, I called in the big guns. I invoked the help of archangels, master spirits who were available, the whole works. And the battle went on for quite a while. Finally, Abel says, "All dark force entities have been removed." But then he says, "However, Joseph, who is very powerful in the dark hierarchy, has been rescued by the dark forces." So he was taken away by their own group. Then all of a sudden, I saw this evil smile come over the patient. And I said, "Abel, what's going on?" And he said, "An extremely powerful dark force has now showed up." And I said, "Is he attached?" He says, "No, he's everywhere and he's difficult to get rid of." And then the entity said, "You know me, we go back a long way." And then he left.
We'll be back with more with Dr. Charles Tremont on Coast to Coast AM.